So you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto trust. Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Plus, it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
I can't wait for, like, the episode of, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants, like, team up and they overpower the hosts and they share the money.
Bottom-up horizontal connection is sharing at all levels, not top-down control.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
My name is Dan Platt. Welcome to the Three Left Show. This is a leftist reading hour for moving in a different direction for a post-capitalist world and generally looking at bringing you news analysis and looking at the issues from a radical left-wing perspective. I've been an activist for a number of years. I want to talk about Green New Deal stuff, or particularly frame this around eco-socialism, which is brand new flavor created in the last few decades. It's basically socialism plus the environmental movement and all the lessons learned through that and the decades of experience, veteran activists and theorists thinking about what does it mean to really be sustainable? What kind of economy does that look like? How do we transition to it? All very large and broad questions, which I will tease some answers to further explore yourself, or will be explored in the future, as this show is an ongoing conversation, one that can include you via Twitter, Facebook, not yet directly. I need a volunteer to be an engineer so I can take calls in the studio, otherwise we have that capability. And I would love to do episodes every now and then that are completely call-based, or devote half the show to taking calls after talking for an hour about maybe one to two particular things instead of just me talking for 2 hours, which can be quite the grind, even though I do get to usually everything I want to talk about, providing that you, the listener, wants to listen to 2 hours. I have a piece. I had a choice between kind of two pieces from longer pieces from Left Voice, which is much more radical left. I mean, it's basically when I want to turn to what a radical left viewpoint, I go to Left Voice. They do have a printed publication as well. But anyway, the two pieces that I could choose from, the one that I'm not going to read is something that I've kind of covered before in smaller bites, just not a more cohesive part, which is a critique of the Democratic Party and even the Green Party's Green New Deal. The predication that, you know, we just need to fix capitalism, that these are reforms, that in fact we just need another New Deal. Similarly, the New Deal in the 30s and 40s, particularly the 30s, is what we're talking about, fixed capitalism, or it saved it from a revolutionary movement, both left-wing and right-wing, which existed at the time. And it was all very uncertain. So something had to be done, demands needed to be caved into. There needed to be some unrest, which is kind of where I'm coming, the angle that if I'm making a pitch for anything with this episode, rather besides informing you on what eco-socialism kind of looks like, what kind of policies make it up, so I'll be covering that. First, an anecdote of why I started the show. I always had the idea of I love podcasts, and every lover of podcasts probably wants to start one. They are wicked easy to start, but filling a niche, what would you actually do? And I was always kind of waffling on that until Dan Carlin, you may know his name from Hardcore History. He's always in the top 10 podcasts on iTunes. He also had a political show, past tense, Common Sense, Now, why is it past tense? Well, because once Trump was elected, he basically dropped a hat and said, nothing makes sense anymore. So there's no point in having a show called Common Sense. That's the short, cheeky version of that. The longer, the more elaborate version is that he basically ran out of things to say. After decades, rather the last 20 years, of covering the issues, you know, he's Mr. Independent Thinker. He would cover the expansion of the security state, the corruption and the selling out of the media, how we don't have a functioning media, how our institutions are breaking down, democratic institutions in particular. Of course, authoritarian institutions have never been stronger. Our police, our military, and propaganda outlets. But he's a Gen Xer who, and this is something I'll get into with this piece from Left Voice, trying to explain where the ideas come from that you can have reform without unrest. But you see, there you can't have reforms without unrest. So that's the main premise of this episode, that reform requires unrest. And there's too many out there, too many friends, too many allies, potential allies, who believe that reforms can be gained without unrest. And the thing with Dan Carlin and why he had to stop doing his show, intellectually speaking, that he felt he did not have legitimacy to do that is because he would always talk about the Gordian knot, referring to how calcified our structures are, that our institutions properly functioning, our democracy can reform based on need, adapt to change, and thus the need for unrest is unnecessary, which I believe, I interpret as being a delusion born out of winning the Cold War. They're napping about unrest, they're against unrest because of, you know, it is a conflict with the principles of nonviolence, that usually unrest entails breaking something. It might have, it's undisciplined, even though unrest can be very organized, and that's how violence is minimized, if not completely stopped. It's actually the unrest that he foresees, which is undisciplined, unorganized, because organization is very hard to do in America, because we've all been trained to think as individuals, and trained to think that reforms can be won without unrest. So let's go forward here with a piece from the Left Voice, How Are Radical Reforms Won? Lessons from the New Deal. The New Deal's Wagner Act, focusing on that in particular, was the biggest concession ever to U.S. labor. It basically was the kind of pinnacle of the labor movement in America. The dominant narrative is that we should thank FDR and Senator Robert Wagner for it, but a close examination shows that it was thanks to radical labor activists and a wave of labor unrest that workers won their rights. General contention that all rights are won through some form of unrest. I think there's a rosy picture, a false picture painted of the civil rights movement, that it was all nonviolent unrest, when there was in fact a lot of other types of unrest, you know, the kind that breaks windows. The Green New Deal offers a vision for radical changes to our economy, including a massive public investment in infrastructure and a federal job guarantee. As the name implies, the magnitude of the policy proposal is comparable only to the radical economic and social policies of the New Deal in the 30s. How was that one possible? Was it a product of savvy liberal politicians, or a response to mass working class unrest that threatened to become revolutionary? Faced with an extraordinarily dire economic situation in the wake of the Great Depression, pressured by emboldened labor movement and growing social unrest, the FDR administration took equally extraordinary measures in an attempt to revitalize the economy and appease labor. The first period of the New Deal was characterized by a broad and partially contradictory array of policies directed primarily at assisting failing capitalists, like bailouts, and to a lesser degree as a response to workers' unrest, particularly miners. In 1933, the National Industrial Recovery Act, or NIRA, was a hodgepodge of regulations in partial conflict with each other. This may sound familiar to the stimulus package of 2009, crafted at the size and measure of business's whim. It was supposed to bring order to the economy and stimulate growth by lifting antitrust regulations. Oh, liberalization, lower those rates, cut those regulations, what few existed at the time, fixing prices and wages, so either keeping wages low as well, and eliminating or reducing competition among firms. But it was a blatant failure. No one complained when, 2 years later, the Supreme Court struck it down. One provision of NYRA was Section 7A, was especially designed to win the support of labor. It granted workers the right to organize in unions to, as the usual talking point goes, bargain collectively through reps of their own choosing. It formally protected workers trying to unionize at their workplace and banned company-run unions, which would be, you know, the boss's organization. But it was never enforced. The bill had no teeth and effectively went unheard by companies and government officials alike. The field of class struggle was still, functionally speaking, lawless, a terrain where scabs were fended off with bare knuckles and clubs, and bosses often resorted to illegal arm bans to try to rein workers back to work. The first phase of the New Deal did not bring about any recovery and proved ineffective in mediating labor conflicts. So just a year after NYRA was passed, in 1934, a major wave of strikes swept the country with prominent confrontations in Minneapolis, San Fran, and Toledo. These big three episodes of labor insurgency in 1934 were all led by socialists of different stripes in a Marxist tradition. But in 1935, something extraordinary happened. The new law, National Labor Relations Act, or the Wagner Act, expanded workers' rights, increasing protection for seeking union recognition and enforcing collective bargaining. So it actually was a law that had teeth. The NLRA was passed by Congress despite the opposition of big business organizations which feared it. It would give too much power to the growing American Federation of Labor. This was not an isolated bill, of course. It was accompanied by a host of other proactive policies. That's what makes the New Deal a number of policies and not just one. These included massive public works projects like the WPA, as well as the Social Security Act, which then established pension system for a certain amount of people, which would then be expanded later. The extraordinary development events during these years raises the question of how these reforms came to pass, in particular with regard to workers' rights. You know, expansion of rights is always hard to obtain. Expanding the Constitution, or what does the Constitution cover? Was it the goodwill of a bold FDR? Was it the staunch insistence of a liberal senator? Did the realignment of political forces provide a unique window of opportunity, which we have to wait for again? Was it mostly a response to labor unrest? A heated debate on this question took place among scholars some 40 years ago, and this article will now revisit it. So what I just read laid out the chronology of events that now we're going to discuss how to view these events. So there'll be first from Stockpo will be an institutionist interpretation, which may sound and feel familiar because it's what most of our corporate media, liberal media, whatever you call it, it's what people usually go to when discussing how reforms occur. And what we need to do as activists to get those reforms done. And they usually then say it is materially backed up because there'll be some winnable reforms or something that was accomplished through appealing to the right lawmaker with minimal protest. So here's the narrative that you know, and it comes from a scholar named Stockpole. Writing for the Journal of Politics and Society in 1980, so that particular date might have some relevance to when this narrative started being used and repeated, attempted to debunk different Marxist theories of the state. In their view, the traditional pluralist paradigm of political power, which is the kind of base level way of viewing how government, you know, and American democracy works, which is the most naive. So the pluralist paradigm of political power, in which governmental decisions stem from an unbiased competition of different interest groups in a society. This is how local politics are still kind of viewed, and it's unhelpful. How? Because it has no explanatory power. You know, what's the point of having a theory of how things work if it doesn't explain anything like how the New Deal was passed? In other words, she writes off from the beginning the idea that the state represents the will of the majority. Of course it doesn't. Sackrow then contended that Marx's theories of the state, while much more promising in terms of explanatory power, also fail to successfully explain New Deal reforms. Their main shortcoming is that they all see class struggle as the main driving force of any change, whereas in her view, the determining factor of the New Deal era was the transformation of U.S. political institutions themselves, in particular the government and the Democratic Party, and an independent activity of prominent individuals in this setting. So it's an assumption that the Democratic Party fundamentally changed in the New Deal era. I would argue it didn't. It simply acquiesced to a particular interest group, i.e. militant labor organizations. So the question is asked, to continue from Stockpearl's view, the determinant factor for the passage of the actual labor law was the unique political scenario opened by the Great Depression. So it's just a general view that, you know, you need the right conditions and the right people at the right time. And when are we going to have that in our times, right? If you're going to apply that kind of thinking. There's a kind of fatalism that, like, we need the stars to align and we need to cast the die and ask all the analysts on TV, you know, when is the right time to push for reform? And as far as they're concerned, as far as some Democratic candidates, you know, up until this primary season, there was never a good time. Don't pass for single payer. No. Don't pass for this. Don't push for that. It's not the right time. We don't have enough of the right people in Congress. We don't have the right economy for it, they say. And maybe they're right. We don't have the right economy to push for reforms. You push for reforms when things are low. And that's what this gets to eventually. A critical alignment took place, indeed, during those years. One that allowed the Democratic Party to sweep the 34 elections with FDR at the helm. It is worth remembering that in order to secure the support of Southern Democrats, the New Deal excluded from this National Labor Relations Act, as well as the Social Security Act, agricultural and domestic workers, occupations that were disproportionately held by Southern blacks. This ensured that the Southern economic order, which rested on low-cost, segregated labor, would not be jeopardized. Thus, with their standard of living basically either being the same or worse, cause for the mass migration of Southern blacks to northern cities in the 40s and 50s, so on and so forth. When Stockpearl emphasizes the autonomous action of individual politicians, that they're autonomous, that they're acting on their own, free from the jumble of struggle out there in the real world, and downplays the role of labor unrest, she is disputing Marx's theory of the state, in which class struggle plays a prominent role in forcing pro-working class concessions from the government. And to counter, you know, milquetoast activism, I point to the kinds of unrest happening in the world today, which is very exciting. There's in Lebanon, Sudan, Chile, Ecuador. The list is growing longer and longer. And yes, even Hong Kong. Unrest wins concessions. Not just words, right? But really, like, they drop their austerity plans. They drop the screwing they were going to deliver the people. And now there's an opening now for gains if the unrest continues, which it likely will. Like in Lebanon, where now you have actual solidarity between all ethnic groups there, because now they have realized that it is rich versus poor, not Sunni versus Shia, or Christian versus non-Christian, or what have you, or Arab versus non-Arab. It is billionaire versus not billionaire, and America versus everyone else. Different tangent, but I wanted to emphasize that there's stuff happening right now that backs up what I'm saying about you don't get reforms, you don't win anything from the state unless you fight for it, actually fight for it, not just talk and make pretty speeches and do what Hollywood movies show. Although it's interesting that in these times of growing unrest, that you have some movies perhaps with more bite. Joker, which is then becomes real life as Lebanese and Chilean protesters are starting to put on some Joker makeup. And then there's an upcoming Harry Tubman movie, which shows the more accurate portrayal of Harry Tubman as the hardliner. I'll shoot you if you try to go back. And gun-toting, very militant activism of Harry Tubman. Yes, in autonomous action of individual politicians and downplays the role of labor unrest. This theory, as well expounded by Fred Bloch in his 1977 essay, The Ruling Class Does Not Rule, Bloch proposes that in order to understand how the capitalist state works, we need to think of state managers, referring to politicians, technocrats, and other types of bureaucrats, as a distinct actor in the relationship between capital, workers, and the state as an institution. So a subsection, or maybe it could be reclassified as the previously mentioned professional managerial class, that they are a class interest unto themselves. So in normal circumstances, state managers seek first and foremost for their own continuity, you know, to stay in office, whether through reelection or direct appointment. At the same time, their likelihood of being reelected depends on a healthy economic growth, pro-growth economy. Thus, if we are to have a sustainable economy that, you know, maybe equalizes or degrows, we have to create a different incentive structure, because right now, just like then, the incentive is to keep the economy growing. A burgeoning economy enables job creation, expands the government's tax revenue to implement social programs. If unemployment is on the rise and businesses are closing, it is unlikely that those same politicians will be reelected, right? And since economic activity is heavily affected by investment decisions by major corporations, you know, people with capital, banks, business people wield an outsized influence over government policies. State managers then are strongly compelled, not so autonomous, to generate or maintain a favorable business environment. You see that play out in our politics every day when you're looking for it. Yield to businesses' demands and provide all kinds of subsidies, guarantees to protect capitalist profits. You know, whatever rhetoric is coming out of the politicians' mouths, this is what is always on the agenda, creating a favorable business environment. And of course, some do speak as that is the only thing that matters. In fact, when it comes to technocrats, even when it sounds like something very socially good, like, say, Andrew Yang's basic income, its still bottom line purpose is to create a better business environment. And better business environments are more for the sake of capitalists and owners and not workers or even middle managers. When social unrest and working class pressure increases to such an extent that it threatens these profits, the health of the economy overall, as a consequence, sometimes even the stability of the whole regime, you know, the state, state managers are ready to then accommodate workers' demands so far as they don't substantially affect capitalist accumulation, you know, the ability to keep making profits later, which is what occurred with the New Deal, that gave in the workers' demands to some extent, but the ability to generate enough money, stay rich enough to then eventually buy back all the politicians, it maybe took another 20 years, but they did it. The system was left intact. So in this perspective, there is only a limited margin for making concessions to the working class. But there are special circumstances, however. When capital's leverage over government is weakened, one of them being in a deep economic crisis, the threat of disinvestment by big business is no longer an effective weapon. They don't have that axe to hold over people's necks. There is already low investment. It is in these situations when, according to Bloch, government officials then have more leeway, more freedom, to effect extraordinary transformation in social policy in favor of working people, assuming these officials are under the unbearable pressure of mass mobilization and unruly unions. Such a concession becomes a major win then for a working movement. At the same time, the outcome has the effect of legitimating the state in the eyes of those same masses, granting rights to a new section of workers and incorporating them into then the state through these new institutional channels. You know, creating the National Labor Relations Board, which then effectively contains what used to be a rebellious movement. You win over rebels by bringing them into the state, giving them a seat at the table, et cetera, et cetera. So this is where I kind of get into thinking, like, reforms are one, progressive movements, they kind of have to stay outside of the law. And by outside the law, I don't mean being ultra-violent or whatever. There are plenty of things we do that are outside of the law, as long as there's no existing regulation on it or way of interacting with the state. And usually what people complain about overregulation, they mean the state is regulating and making lawful more and more things, bringing more things into its roundhouse, so to speak. So Scott Gross says this was not the case in 1930, though. She asserts that it was not so much the threat of organized labor that forced the hand of government to grant this particular reform, the National Labor Relations Act, but rather the actions of government officials that protected and encouraged workers to unionize, go on strike, and then emerge from the New Deal on a much stronger footing. So this is the kind of mindset of Democratic establishment, most Democrats, is that you need, first you need the right people in office, and that will then encourage people to be more radical. This is actually, now it hits me, I wasn't planning on talking this way, but that's, I'm going to vamp here. This is kind of what comes to mind when I think about the Bernie Sanders movement. Even Chapo Trap House, radical dirtbags they are, will say, like, you know, it will radicalize more people when Bernie is president. Bernie needs to be president, and then people are more comfortable with being more radical. But I think this is getting things a little backwards. It's because people were more radical with Occupy, just slightly more people, still a smaller movement, didn't inspire, you know, millions to strike, but it was the beginning of it. It was the sea change. It was a little bit of unrest, of unlawful activity, nonviolent unlawful activity, that showed everyone's, and I mean everyone's, true colors. Because it was after Occupy, you start, anyone who said they were a strong liberal started talking more like a conservative, and you had people like Bernie Sanders go from a lower level senator to the focus of a national movement, at the very least to get him elected, with the goal of then, even if he doesn't win all of the things he's quote unquote promising, it is about inspiring even more people to step up, which I don't disagree with, but I'm saying, what is the real cause of people standing up? Is it just because they've heard Bernie Sanders say something they liked? I think the sentiment was already there. And so this is, but here's the dueling narratives here, that the case from Stockpro in 1980 was that reform and change of any type is made through having the right people in office, and that makes people, you know, the masses more comfortable with fighting for what they need, and not the actual fact that they need things. So let's go to that counter argument from a Goldfield. 9 years after this Stockpro's article was published, so meaning in 1989, when I was one, political scientist Michael Goldfield wrote a powerful rebuttal. Goldfield turned the argument around. In his view, the New Deal legislation resulted from the interaction of a strong labor movement, radical currents organizing within it, notably the Communist Party, liberal reformers with close ties to capital and state managers who then acted to preserve the stability of the system of governance, you know, American liberal democracy, and thus thereby stay in office. And although Wagner and his team had a strong influence on the specific content of the bill, the impetus for it to be enacted was provided by a wave of labor unrest and growing influence of radicalism in the labor movement, not the other way around. The strongest point in Goldfield's argument is the chronology of the events. Now this goes into kind of media literacy and media interpretation, that good media will give you full context, a full chronology. And I always notice when, and appreciate, when news broadcasters say, they say like, okay, here's the chronology of events leading up to the thing I'm going to talk about now. But where usually, say, MSNBC news broadcasters fail is where they don't go far back enough, or they don't include enough events to give a full context. So like, say, usually, the narratives about the New Deal leave out the unrest altogether. Thus, making it very sensible to assume that it was just having the liberal politicians be elected in 33 or 32. And then in the next 4 years, they passed the New Deal reforms. That's the boilerplate version we're taught in school. Not the sit-down strikes, not the mass mobilization, the riots. Similar with the civil rights movement, which is more recent. And now in our times, not on the same scale yet, because I don't think things have gotten bad enough. Not that I'm truly an accelerationist, but the accelerationist point is things need to get bad enough before people start really organizing for what they need, because things are still, you know, we've got just enough of a safety net left that, you know, we don't need to riot. Okay, so just a year before the Wagner Act was passed, the U.S. saw a strike epidemic, in the words of contemporary commentators, like it had never seen before. The Trotskyist-led Teamsters strike in Minneapolis, as well as the general strike in San Francisco, and the auto light strike in Toledo defied both the law and the repressive forces of the state, and it won, sending a clear message to workers fighting around the country. So is it fair to assume that the political climate had changed so much in just a year that no major defeats for labor in the interim? Goldfield points out that the historic wave of strikes in 34 was, in 35, still vivid in everyone's minds. In 34, events hang like a veil over the NLRA hearings and floor debates, not just in 34, but through the spring of 35. Moreover, they were a centerpiece of Wagner's own speech to Congress when he made the case for the labor law. Remember, this is the labor law that basically legalized unions. Unions were always pretty much illegal and not recognized by the state, and thus why would owners recognize the unions? They would say, you're not recognized by the state, why should I recognize you? You're unlawful. I'm going to call the cops on you now. And they did. And what about the spectacular increase in union membership after 35? A mainstay of liberal narratives about the New Deal and a linchpin in Scott Pro's thesis is that the dramatic increase in union membership after 35 was a direct consequence of Congress passing the NLRA. After all, unionization increased in 37 from 4 million to 7 million workers, according to records of the Bureau of Labor. But the problem with this argument is that the Wagner Act was not upheld by the Supreme Court until April of 37. Before this, practically no employer recognized the Labor Relations Board as a mediator as labor conflicts continued and the law went unenforced. Sounds maybe like Obamacare, where we have years of litigation that kept it from being fully implemented until basically Obama leaves office. In December 1936, the sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan broke out and afforded the UAW. So again, now I'm bringing in what this article brings in, new events into the chronology as it's going forward since the law has been passed, but strikes are continuing, which then empowers more strikes or inspires more strikes. Kind of like, you know, unrest, you know, Bolivia stands up, then Lebanon, then Sudan first, Haiti is in general unrest right now. They're on the margins of the empire. They're on the margins in the world economy, ruled by our puppets. In the aftermath of the Flint strike, Goldfield recounts, General Motors, Chrysler, and Big Steel were unionized, along with hundreds of other companies. Within 1 month after the end of the Flint strike, 247 other sit-down strikes had taken place. Almost 250, involving almost 200,000 workers. Union membership surged to over 7 million by the end of that year, and thus the dam had been broken with little help from the Labor Relations Board. To be sure, scholars including Goldfield agree that the passing of the labor law in 35 probably had a symbolic impact on workers and trade union militants, encouraged further labor unrest, even if it didn't actually protect them. But the importance of workers' unrest, led in many cases by members of the Communist Party or the Trotskyist Socialist Workers' Party, looms much larger in historical perspective. Furthermore, the wave of strikes are only the most prominent episodes of social unrest in the mid-30s. Millions organized in the largest unemployed workers' movement the U.S. had seen. Many of them were black. The Communist Party played a leading role in the movement of the unemployed. Communist and socialist rallies drew tens of thousands in New York. And this is not even mentioning the growth of the Socialist Party as a third party in American electoral politics. Because this publication usually skews away from the electoral. But speaking of these parties as labor organizers. The Communist Party played a leading role in the movement of the unemployed. They drew tens of thousands. In big cities like New York and Chicago, Francis Fox Piven recounts that after a confrontation between unemployed workers and police outside Detroit, in which four protesters were killed, their coffins were carried behind red banners with Lenin's portrait to the sound of the Russian funeral march. Which I believe, in my mind, it's the Singers on the Volga, which is, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. After spearheading one of the most preeminent labor struggles in Minneapolis, the Trotskyists were then expelled from the unions. The communists had much more deeply penetrated the labor movement, were also pushed out or forced underground a few years later by the Taft-Hartley Act. With the collaboration of the American Federation of Labor and the CIO officials, as is evident today, the elimination of the most radical elements from the ranks of unions would have profound and lasting consequences for the U.S. labor movement. It should be noted that not even the most decisive government intervention could bring the economic crisis to an end. A new phase of growth and capital accumulation only began with the extraordinary mobilization of resources for the Second World War, which turned empty factories into war production units and the destruction and later reconstruction of Europe through the Marshall Plan. Notice it said both. The destruction of it, you know, because you make all the weapons to destroy it, and then you then produce all the stuff to rebuild it. It also helped that all of the rest of the world's industrial capacity had diminished because their cities were bombed, but America's had not. So it kind of left us a 15-year window where America was the producer of stuff. And you'll notice that as soon as all the other industrial economies basically were rebuilt, took 15, 20 years, that's when our economy started, the high times started going away. We were hit with the 60s recession and everything else. Especially with 1970, we have to go off the labor gold standard, so on, so on. Lessons for today. Scott Pro tried to reboot Goldfield's rejoinder the following year, but her and Feingold's critique was torn apart by Goldfield's own response in the same volume. Since then, the thesis that autonomous reform politicians were to be credited for the pro-labor legislation in the New Deal has been left only for dubious anti-Marxist scholarship and to the uninformed common-sense liberals. Which goes back to Dan Carlin, who he called his show Common Sense. And he had the kind of, like, we need the right people in. But he, being a historical thinker, he would know institutions matter. He knows unrest matters. But privately, he's so against unrest, he never wants to be part of it. He doesn't want it to happen at all. But he stopped his show because after Trump was elected, it was like, I don't see any way forward without some unrest happening. And since I'm totally against unrest and I don't even want to talk about, he could talk about unrest, you know, how what form would it take? It just bummed him out too much because he would never take part of it. So he could never be an active participant in what's to come or what needs to happen, even if we all don't want it to happen. But that is what is happening. Gotta face it. Get rid of the fairy tales of having the right person. Now, of course, as this is mentioned, talking about, and I would never discount it, that it really helps to have a sympathetic person in office, right? So it's not saying one has to be done and not the other, right? Electing sympathetic politicians, the people who will, you know, but even though, like with Wagner and the liberal politicians, their main concern is keeping capitalism going. That's what pays their salaries. It's what keeps them with the positions they have. So even when they're doing the right thing or being sympathetic to workers' movements or social justice movements. It's still in the name of preserving the system overall, which then, you know, which in my mind, and I've argued for, causes these issues in the first place as a society. The lessons of the New Deal couldn't be more clear, says this article. It took a mighty working class mobilization, including disruptions and illegal actions, and the effective threat of a growing anti-capitalist movement to obtain the concessions for labor embodied by the Wagner Act. And this is kind of what, if there's anything that really worries me and makes me apoplectic, it's thinking about how my life will be devoted to building an anti-capitalist movement that at the end of my lifetime will have just one similar step forward, you know, two steps forward, one step back kind of reforms. Because just as the creation of the National Labor Relations Board and the things won during the New Deal era, the 30s, it was a step back for the left. As mentioned, the unions kicked out anyone who was more militant, more revolutionary. They had to go underground. They were then pretty much made illegal by the end of World War II. Thus, the McCarthy hearings and the beginning of the Cold War. To be a militant labor organizer was to be a traitor to the country, a foreign asset or agent, whatever, whatever word you want to use. Furthermore, the NLRA, that's the National Labor Relations Act, contributed to co-opting the labor movement from the moment it was enacted. It shifted the logic of union organizing from one in which workers were forced to act in militant but also more solidaric ways, generally by organizing an overwhelming majority of the workforce and then conducting a prolonged strike. If the strike led to victory and the union was recognized by the bosses, there was no legal compulsion to continue recognizing the union. Thus, unions were forced to constantly maintain solidarity and community. But after the passage of the Labor Act, unionization was predicated then, as it was now codified, by a vote of 50% plus one, with the bosses legally then compelled to recognize that result. The explosive, unruly nature of workers' direct action then gave way to the institutionalized process of reps, grievance procedures, mutual responsibility, meaning unions now are just as responsible for profits as the owners are. And thus, you have unions that don't fight anymore, that were then, from that moment onward, even like in those years, their membership exploded, but then it never went up again because they were always on the defensive. They were never fighting for more, only to retain what was won in those days, or an extension of it with, you know, cost of living adjustments. You know, the next contract. Always eyes on the next contract, and striking is more trouble than it's worth. It costs, it puts us all at threat. We can't, you know, I've talked to union reps today, and in the union I was in, it was it's a grocery store, and it's a very much bureaucratic union. No one actually likes it. We like the benefits, we recognize it, but they also don't fight for themselves. There's no orientation for new hires, you know, because some of them will be fired in a week. So what's the point? What do you mean, what's the point? They should know the benefits of a union, so wherever they work, they want to unionize. I digress. Curiously enough, the main talk around the New Deal today is no longer related to recovering labor rights, but about avoiding climate disaster. Yet the Green New Deal, sponsored by AOC, Bernie Sanders, etc., includes not only extraordinary investments and other infrastructure requirements, but also a federal jobs guarantee. So 2 decades after this working class retreat, the Labor Act barely protects workers' unionizing drives, with right-to-work laws and basically everything that's been happening since then, and the right to strike is ridiculously restricted. A fight to win back, I mean, basically all the strikes that are happening this year are illegal. That's, you might surprise you to know that, but striking for the most part is usually illegal. Like, see, a strike has to be approved by this labor relations board. And who decides who's on this board? the president. Who's president? Who's president, Johnny? Although it has been written off, and who has been president in the inner city in 80 years, you know? Is it always a friend of labor? No, it has not been. Although it has been written off as pie in the sky or an incoherent assemblage of environmental policy, glimpses of a labor relations reform, the bill, Green New Deal talking, has been understood as a declaration of principles. Its purpose was, essentially, to shift the political agenda and radically change the conversation. But even as AOC and Sanders, and now many other Democrats, push hard for these proposals, none of them will be delivered unless there is a sweeping labor unrest or a credible threat to the system itself. Here's where socialists and revolutionaries of various types will play a lead role. The increasing number of strikes seems to be pointing to a new wave of labor unrest. The many decades of capitalist offensive with little or no response to organized labor has reduced workers' rights to the bare bones. Deprived of a public health care option, lacking child care, paid sick leave for the most part, American workers are subordinated to market forces, to the whims of it, to the extreme. Imagine a cliff and a multitude being pushed by a behemoth, which is capital. It is no wonder that workers are standing up now. The level of contradictions in our society has reached such a high level that the explosion this time will be big. Socialists of all stripes will play a leading role in it, says this socialist publication. And the political decisions we make as lefties will shape our prospects for the years to come. Final conclusion here. The lessons of the New Deal are that environmental activists pushing for a Green New Deal, and in particular labor organizers fighting for some sort of new workers' bill of rights, can't rely on smart politicians. Have you met them? Only an independent workers' mass movement will be able to force these kinds of concessions from the ruling class. The owners of capital won't sacrifice a cent of their profits until they face economic disruption that only massive collective action can cause, not a little pithy Facebook boycott or whatever. And until they are legitimately scared of a threat that working class or we pose, that rises and reclaims what is theirs, and the goods, the riches, and the world. So let's see. This was co-authored by, with input from a Cody Metzler, and this was written by Juan Cruz Ferre. Produced May of this year from Left Voice. So I'm reaching towards the end of the hour, as you are listening to WCAA The Voice here in Albany, New York, community run radio station, in which we are all volunteers and need more help. If you want these shows to be more effective and perhaps entertaining, I need someone to step up to be an engineer, meaning work the phones. I would teach you. I'm a pretty sensible teacher, I think. Patient. So for the next hour, I will talk about eco-socialist policies. What are the kinds of things we are fighting for that, now that I've talked at length about how to get reforms and the kinds of issues with that, whether or not you totally agree with me or not, I myself am always kind of muddled about it. But keep moving forward, you know, keep moving forward. This show can be found on all podcasting apps, pretty much all of them, including Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, of course. It's the Three Left Show. There's also, I have a Patreon account to materially support the show, which would actually be supporting this station. Full archive of episodes from the show can be found at threelefts.news. That is the website with a little bit of information, some pages here and there, but particularly the archive is the main attraction. So with that, I will leave you for this hour, but I will be back in the next.
I know I said a favorite peaceful resolution, but that was was when we were the young idealists. The young idealists. Raging through the coffee shops and bars. Make believe the world was really us. Still supposing we could make a difference. Then we bought into the neocon economic dream. And we were trading in futures we believed in. The young idealists, careering through the markets to the mall, venturing that we could have it all, still supposing we could make a difference. Markets fall and the heavens open. There's no synergy at all. The synergy is broken. So maybe now I take that wholesale revolution we were talking about. Maybe now I take a future we can breathe in. Idealists raging through the forests and the streams, breaking into your laboratories, still supposing we could make a difference. I never dreamed I'd want a slogan on my people move. That was when we were the young idealists.
Now to talk about more of the positive, less muddy, less maybe, I don't know about that kind of stuff. So let's talk policy in a positive, optimistic way with from the groups that are doing it. So first, housing. So this is all within the context of me framing it in the with the word eco-socialism. Bernie Sanders has made it, and this is amazing, that even all these other socialists that I've known through my radical career in the last 8 years since Occupy, I was radicalized, started reading and listening to socialists that would call themselves socialists, but not publicly, and wouldn't call what they were doing socialist. Whether they be in the Green Party, whether they be in other radical orgs, very interesting. That, and this is a case where, like, okay, the chronology is a little off. Once Bernie Sanders ran for president in 2016, that made a lot more people comfortable using the word socialist. But still, the chronology is all about broader context. In my mind, Bernie Sanders' run for office as a quixotic expanding the Overton window, the conversation, contributing, didn't expect to win, didn't expect to gain any traction whatsoever. He did so as being inspired by the growing unrest and the desire for him to, or the desire for a voice like his to be part of the Democratic primary, which to me stems from Occupy. So the unrest I participated in, I'm just tooting my own horn, started the ball rolling because, and I said this in the last hour, I'll repeat it, it showed people's true colors. You know, are they really, you know, for the people who talk like they want change and reform, but they're really just for the status quo. They're willing to go to bat for the corrupt. And you see that in the quote-unquote strange bedfellows of Bush administration wonks and participants. You know, David Frum, who wrote his speeches. They're all buddies with other top Dems. So anyway, enough with the politicking and the stuff that makes people upset. How about some of the things that more makes us go, that's interesting. How a homes guarantee proposal could make housing a right. So this is from the site Curbed, which covers urban issues. Written by Patrick Sisson, Sisson, September of this year. People's Action Progressive Political Coalition wants to create a public option for green affordable housing. Subtitle. The depths of the nation's affordable housing crisis have spurred Democratic candidates to propose ambitious plans to make it easier to pay for a place to live. A national progressive coalition wants to go one step further and make it not just easier, but a right. The Homes Guarantee, that's bold and with a link, introduced earlier this month, a network representing roughly 1 million. Okay, so the People's Action Coalition, I'm actually not familiar with this group very much, but they're a network representing roughly 1 million progressive activists in groups spanning 30 states, would invest billions of dollars in housing infrastructure, so on and so on, but restructure the way the housing market works. Funded in part by a $1 trillion investment in the Housing Trust Fund and a $1 trillion bond offering on top of it. Along with proposals by leading Democratic primary contenders, notably Sanders, just announced this $2.5 trillion plan. Now, the number seems extraordinarily high, but when you think about it, that's kind of the budget of the military. And if we just simply took half of those resources for killing people and put it into housing everybody, I think that would be much better. Wouldn't you? The Homes Guarantee shows the energy and ambition coursing through left-wing circles through around rebuilding and reimagining U.S. housing policy. It also sets a high bar for any future candidate-backed plan. You just care about candidates. But I more care about large organizations like this one. That's where the power is, you know, people power. The problem is simple. Bankers, developers, and landlords have been allowed to charge our families more and more and provide us with less and less, says Rose Fernandez, member of New York's Community Voices Heard, one of the groups within this larger coalition. In a state, they wrote, they created a system to maximize their profit above all else. So our solution is equally simple. Change the whole system. Put people first. So this comes in the form of, to put it in a simple phrase for the policy, just like, you know, single-payer health care, Medicaid for all. This would be called massive public housing investment. Basically turning half of the housing market go public, you know, nationalizing all of it, or publicizing, socializing, all housing is mostly undesirable, no matter what politics you have. Half of it would accomplish a stabilization of housing pricing, taking enough of the stock off of the market, making it, you know, as it's called, decommodifying it. Because when something is made a commodity, it's made to be bought and sold for a profit. Whether it be housing, whether it be your time, childcare, you know, the stuff that we don't want to be profitable, or once it is, it's made terrible. Tara Rogravier, the housing policy lead for the People's Action, told Curb that the Homes Guarantee is, in their words, the boldest plan for housing justice seen in decades, at least in American politics, comes as candidates are finally speaking about the issue. Because I want to mention that in European Reconstruction in the 50s and 60s, it was all public housing. So for the most part, their housing prices are a lot better, as well as, at least at the time, the housing situation was rather good compared to America. And this comes as candidates are finally speaking about the issue. I mean, when have Democrats talked about actually increasing money to public housing? The narrative has always been about how we need to not have it at all. But of course, that has been a disaster. Just look at the rents in our large cities. There is literally a meme that the rent is too damn high. A proactive and reparative solution to the housing crisis. The far-reaching Homes Guarantee was formulated by a group of 100 grassroots leaders over 14 months and would both boost spending and support for renters while fundamentally shifting the mechanics of the housing market. During a retreat in upstate New York last July and August, local activists and members of the People's Action Coalition felt the issue needed a rallying cry, akin to the labor movement's Fight for 15 campaign, to create a bold vision for how things can change. The kind of proposal can awaken the political imagination. Again, all these things, 5 for 15, they occurred after Occupy. The proposal views the national housing crisis. A full-time worker earning minimum wage cannot afford a two-bedroom apartment in any county in the nation, per the National Low Income Housing Coalition. 21 million households, disproportionately those of color, spend over 30% of their income on housing. This is a moral and political failure. First, the platform proposes to build 12 million new social housing units. So instead of using the word public housing, it's social housing. Because it doesn't have to be state-owned, it could be socially owned. The point is for the state or the public to build the housing for the public good. And then that housing, as people are put into it, they buy it, maybe they're renting, but the point is that these are social units, that they could be socially owned, there could be schemes that these public housing blocks, you know, whatever they are, they could be scattershot, that they are co-ops, that they're land trusts, that it isn't just tower blocks anymore. It certainly wouldn't be again. That was the mistake of the 60s, to just make big tower blocks, which was very, you know, avant-garde at one time, back in the 30s, speaking as an architectural nerd. These 12 million units would be targeted towards the 12 million who are extremely cost-burdened. These renters who spend more than half their income on rent. 12 million people. And invest $150 billion in existing public housing infrastructure. So to shore up the existing stock. Part two of this, second, along with the dramatic increase of the stock of quality, affordable. Now, I'm wishy-washy about using the word affordable. Affordable to who? Now, obviously, affordable to someone with minimum wage income, I suppose, is in this context. In other contexts, affordable refers to someone with a middle-class income, a $50,000 income, whatever. So then it becomes more a word. The word I kind of liked for a bit was attainable housing, that anyone can attain the housing, even if maybe you have no income.
A reminder that word of mouth is the best thing to do, your part in growing the show and the number of like-minded people. You can leave a review on the podcast platforms where this show is listed and share the Three Lefts via your chosen social media platform, with the most effective means being in real life. We are on Facebook and Twitter. To support the show more materially, visit our Patreon page and become a member there. All money raised will go to outreach as a specific goal. Links are currently found in the show description. Sources for each episode are in the show info tab and listed on our website, threelefts.news. A full backlog of episodes are also there, along with other info and sources. This has been Dan Platt.